This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents An Unquiet Mind by K. Redfield Jameson. Read for you by the author.
An Unquiet Mind. When it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're manic, even the UCLA Medical Center has a certain appeal. Ordinarily, a cold clotting of uninteresting buildings, the hospital became for me, that fall morning not quite 20 years ago, a focus of my finely wired, exquisitely alert nervous system. With antennae perked and eyes fast-forwarding, I took in everything around me. I was on the run. Not just on the run, but fast and furious on the run, darting back and forth across the hospital parking lot, trying to use up an endless, restless, manic energy. I was running fast, but slowly going mad. The man I was with, a colleague from the medical school, had stopped running an hour earlier and was, he said impatiently, exhausted. This, to a saner mind, would not have been surprising. The endless hours of scotch, brawling, and falling about in laughter had taken an obvious, if not final, toll. Suddenly a police car pulled up. The officer had his hand on his gun as he got out of the car. "What in the hell are you doing running around the parking lot at this hour?" he asked. A not unreasonable question. My few remaining islets of judgment linked up long enough to conclude that this particular situation was going to be hard to explain. My colleague, fortunately, was thinking far better than I was, and said, "We're both on the faculty in the psychiatry department." The policeman looked at us, smiled, went back to his squad car, and drove away. Being professors of psychiatry explained everything. Within a month of signing my appointment papers to become an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Los Angeles, I was well on my way to madness. It was 1974, and I was 28 years old. Within 3 months, I was manic beyond recognition, and just beginning a long, costly personal war against a medication that I would, in a few years' time, be strongly encouraging others to take. My illness and my struggles against the drug that ultimately saved my life and restored my sanity had been years in the making. For as long as I can remember, I was frighteningly, although often wonderfully, beholden to moods. Intensely emotional as a child, mercurial as a young girl, first severely depressed as an adolescent, and then unrelentingly caught up in the cycles of manic depressive illness by the time I began my professional life, I became, both by necessity and intellectual inclination, a student of moods. It has been the only way I know to understand, indeed to accept, the illness I have. It also has been the only way I know to try and make a difference in the lives of others who also suffer from mood disorders. The disease that has, on several occasions, nearly killed me, does kill tens of thousands of people every year. Most are young, most die unnecessarily, and many are among the most imaginative and gifted that we as a society have. The Chinese believe that before you can conquer a beast, you first must make it beautiful. In some strange way, I have tried to do that with manic depressive illness. It has been my fascinating, albeit deadly, enemy and companion. I have found it to be seductively complicated, a distillation both of what is finest in our natures and what is most dangerous. In order to contend with it, I first had to know it in all of its moods and infinite disguises, understand its real and imagined powers. Because my illness seemed to me, initially, simply to be an extension of myself, that is to say, of my ordinarily changeable moods, energies, and enthusiasms, I perhaps gave it at times too much quarter. And because I thought I ought to be able to handle my increasingly violent mood swings by myself, for the first 10 years I did not seek any kind of treatment. Even after my condition became a medical emergency, I still intermittently resisted the medications that both my training and clinical research expertise told me were the only sensible way to deal with the illness I had. My manias, at least in their early and mild forms, were absolutely intoxicating states that gave rise to great personal pleasure, an incomparable flow of ideas and thoughts, and a ceaseless energy that allowed the translation of new ideas into papers and projects. Medications not only cut into these fast-flowing, high-flying times, They also brought with them seemingly intolerable side effects. It took me far too long to realize that lost years and relationships cannot be recovered, that damage done to oneself and others cannot always be put right again, and that freedom from the control imposed by medication loses its meaning when the only alternatives are death and insanity. The war that I waged against myself is not an uncommon one. The major clinical problem in treating manic depressive illness is not that there are not effective medications. There are, but that patients so often refuse to take them. Worse yet, because of a lack of information, poor medical advice, stigma, or fear of personal and professional reprisals, they do not seek treatment at all. Manic depression is an illness that is biological in its origin, yet one that feels psychological in the experience of it. An illness that is unique in conferring advantage and pleasure, yet one that brings in its wake almost unendurable suffering and, not infrequently, suicide. I am fortunate that I have not died from my illness, fortunate in having received the best medical care available, and fortunate in having the friends, colleagues, and family that I do. Because of this, I have in turn tried to use my own experiences of the disease to inform my research, teaching, clinical practice, and advocacy work. Through writing and teaching, I have hoped to persuade my colleagues of the paradoxical core of this quicksilver illness that can both kill and create, and, along with many others, have tried to change public attitudes about psychiatric illnesses in general and manic depressive illness in particular. It has been difficult at times to weave together the scientific discipline of my intellectual field of study with the more compelling realities of my own emotional experiences. And yet it has been from this binding of raw emotion to the distanced eye of clinical science that I have obtained the freedom to live the life I want and the human experiences necessary to try and make a difference in public awareness and clinical practice. I have no idea what the long-term effects of discussing such issues so openly will be on my personal and professional life. But whatever the consequences, they are bound to be better than continuing to be silent. I am tired of hiding, tired of misspent and knotted energies, tired of the hypocrisy, and tired of acting as though I have something to hide. One is what one is, and the dishonesty of hiding behind a degree or a title or any collection of words is still exactly that, dishonest. I still have concerns about my decision to be public about my illness. But one of the advantages of having had manic depressive illness for almost 30 years is that very little seems insurmountably difficult. One may be terrified to go forward, but there's no question of going back. I find myself somewhat inevitably taking a certain solace in Robert Lowell's essential question. Yet why not say what happened? I was standing with my head back, one pigtail caught between my teeth, listening to the jet overhead. The noise was loud, unusually so, which meant that it was close. My elementary school was near Andrews Air Force Base, just outside Washington. Many of us were pilots' kids, so the sound was routine. Being routine, however, didn't take away from the magic, and I instinctively looked up from the playground to wave. I knew, of course, that the pilot couldn't see me, just as I knew that even if he could see me, the odds were it wasn't my father. But it was one of those things one did, and anyway, I loved any and all excuses to stare up into the skies. My father, a career Air Force officer, was first and foremost a scientist, and only secondarily a pilot. But he loved to fly, and because he was a meteorologist, both his mind and his soul ended up being in the skies. Like my father, I looked up rather more than I looked out. The noise of the jet had become louder, and I saw the other children in my second-grade class suddenly dart their heads upwards. The plane was coming in very low, then it streaked past us, scarcely missing the playground. As we stood there, absolutely terrified, it flew into the trees, exploding directly in front of us. Within minutes, it seemed, mothers were pouring onto the playground to reassure children that it was not their father's. Fortunately for my brother and sister and myself, it was not ours either. Over the next few days, it became clear, from the release of the young pilot's final message to the control tower, that he knew he could save his own life by bailing out. He also knew, however, that by doing so, he risked that his unaccompanied plane would fall onto the playground and kill those of us who were there. The dead pilot became a hero, transformed into a scorchingly vivid, completely impossible ideal for what was meant by the concept of duty. The memory of the crash came back to me many times over the years, both as a reminder of how one aspires after and needs such ideals, but also of how killingly difficult it is to achieve them. I never again looked at the sky and saw only vastness and beauty. From that afternoon on, I saw that death was also and always there. Although, like all military families, we moved a lot, by the fifth grade, my older brother, sister, and I had attended four different elementary schools, and we had lived in Florida, Puerto Rico, California, Tokyo, and Washington twice. Our parents, especially my mother, kept life as secure, warm, and constant as possible. My brother was the eldest and the steadiest of the three of us children, and my staunch ally, despite the three-year difference in our ages. He was smart, fair, and self-confident, and I always felt that there was a bit of extra protection coming my way whenever he was around. My relationship with my sister, who was only 13 months older than me, was more complicated. She was the truly beautiful one in the family, with dark hair and wonderful eyes. She had a charismatic way, a fierce temper, very black and passing moods, and little tolerance for the conservative military lifestyle. The long and important years of childhood and early adolescence were, for the most part, very happy ones for me, and they afforded me a solid base of warmth, friendship, and confidence. They were to be an extremely powerful amulet, a potent and positive countervailing force against future unhappiness. When involved, my father was often magically involved, ebullient, funny, curious about almost everything, and able to describe with delight and originality the beauties and phenomena of the natural world. A snowflake was never just a snowflake, nor a cloud just a cloud. They became events, characters, part of a lively and ordered universe. When times were good and his moods were at high tide, his infectious enthusiasm would touch everything. Music would fill the house, wonderful new pieces of jewelry would appear, and we'd all settle into our listening mode, for we knew that soon we'd be hearing a great deal about whatever new enthusiasm had taken him over. There was a contagious magic to his expansiveness which I loved. It was enchanting, really, rather like having Mary Poppins for a father. Years later, he gave me a bracelet inscribed with words from Michael Faraday that were engraved over the physics building at UCLA. Nothing is too wonderful to be true. Needless to say, the remark is palpably untrue, but the thought and mood are lovely ones, and very much as my father could be in his wondrous moments. My mother has said many times that she always felt she was in the shadow of my father's wit, charm, intensity, and imagination. My mother, however, was always the one my friends wanted to talk with. We played with my father. We talked with my mother. Mother, who has an absolute belief that it is not the cards that one is dealt in life, it is how one plays them, is, by far, the highest card I was dealt. Kind, fair, and generous, she has the type of self-confidence that comes from having been brought up by parents who not only loved her deeply and well, but who were themselves kind, fair, and generous people. My mother, tall, thin, and pretty, was a popular student in both high school and college. Pictures in her photograph album show an obviously happy young woman, usually surrounded by friends, caught up in sorority activities, or looking slightly Gibson girlish with a series of good-looking boyfriends. Her belief that a certain predictability was something that one ought to be able to count upon must have had its roots in the utter normality of the people and events captured in these pictures, as well as the preceding generations of her ancestors who were reliable, honorable, and saw things through. Centuries of such seeming steadiness in the genes could only partially prepare my mother for all the turmoil and difficulties that were to face her once she left her parents' home to begin a family of her own. But it has been precisely that persevering steadiness of my mother, her belief in seeing things through, and her great ability to love and learn, listen and change, that helped keep me alive through all of the years of pain and nightmare that were to come. She could not have known how difficult it would be to deal with madness. None of us did. But, consistent with her ability to love and her native will, she handled it with empathy and intelligence. It never occurred to her to give up. Both my mother and father strongly encouraged my interest in writing poetry and school plays, as well as in science and medicine. Neither of them tried to limit my dreams, and they had the sense and sensitivity to tell the difference between a phase I was going through and more serious commitments. Even my phases, however, were for the most part tolerated with kindness and imagination. My interest in medicine was lasting, and my parents fully encouraged it. When I was about 12 years old, they gave me dissecting tools, as well as a microscope and a copy of Gray's Anatomy. The latter turned out to be inordinately complicated, but its presence gave me the sense of what I imagined real medicine to be. The ping-pong table in our basement was my laboratory, and I spent endless late afternoons dissecting frogs, fish, worms, and turtles. Doctors at the hospital at Andrews Air Force Base, where I volunteered as a candy striper or nurse's aide on weekends, gave me scalpels, hemostats, and, among other things, bottles of blood for one of my many homemade experiments. Far more important, they took me and my interests very seriously. They never tried to discourage me from becoming a doctor, even though it was an era that breathed, "If woman be a nurse." They took me on rounds with them and let me observe and even assist at minor surgical procedures. One of the doctors allowed me to attend part of an autopsy, which was extraordinary and horrifying. I stood at the side of the steel autopsy table, trying hard not to look at the dead child's small, naked body, but being incapable of not doing so. Eventually, in order to keep from seeing what I was seeing, I reverted back to my usual self, asking question after question. After a while, curiosity became a compelling force in its own right. I focused on the questions and stopped seeing the body. As has been true a thousand times since, my curiosity and temperament had taken me to places I was not really able to handle emotionally. But the same curiosity, and the scientific side of my mind, generated enough distance and structure to allow me to manage, deflect, reflect, and move on. When I was 15, I went with my fellow candy stripers on a group outing to St. Elizabeth's, the federal psychiatric hospital in the District of Columbia. It was, in its own way, a far more horrifying experience than attending the autopsy. All of us were nervous during the bus ride over to the hospital, giggling and making terribly insensitive schoolgirlish remarks in a vain effort to allay our anxieties. I think we were afraid of the strangeness, of possible violence, and what it would be like to see someone completely out of control. "You'll end up at St. Elizabeth's," was one of our childhood taunts. And despite the fact I had no obvious reason to believe that I was anything but passably sane, irrational fears began to poke away at my mind. The hospital itself was not at all the grim place I had imagined it would be. Entering the wards, however, abolished the illusion created by the genteel architecture and landscaping. There was, immediately, the dreadful reality of the sights and sounds and smells of insanity. Far worse, though, was going into the day room of one of the women's wards and looking around at the bizarre clothes, the odd mannerisms, the agitated pacing, strange laughter, and occasional heartbreaking screams. One woman stood like a stork, one leg tucked up. She giggled inanely to herself the whole time I was there. Another patient stood in the middle of the day room, talking to herself and braiding and unbraiding her long reddish hair. Her parents, she said, had put a pinball machine inside her head when she was 5 years old. The red balls told her when she should laugh, the blue ones when she should be silent and keep away from other people. The green balls told her she should start multiplying by 3. Every few days, a silver ball would make its way through the pins of the machine. Although fascinated, I was primarily frightened by the strangeness of the patients, as well as by the perceptible level of terror in the room. Even stronger, however, were the expressions of pain in the eyes of the women. Some part of me instinctively reached out and in an odd way understood this pain, never imagining that I would someday look in the mirror and see their sadness and insanity in my own eyes. Throughout my adolescence, I was fortunate in being actively encouraged to pursue my medical and scientific interests not just by my parents and the physicians at Andrews, but by many of my parents' friends as well. It is only now, in looking back, after many deflating experiences later in life when I was told either to lower my sights or to rein in my enthusiasms, that I fully appreciate the seriousness with which my ideas were taken by my parents and their friends. And it is only now that I really begin to understand how desperately important it was to both my intellectual and emotional life to have had my thoughts and enthusiasms given not only respect, but active encouragement. An ardent temperament makes one very vulnerable to dream killers, and I was more lucky than I knew in having been brought up around enthusiasts and lovers of enthusiasts. So I was almost totally content. I had great friends, a full and active life of swimming, riding, softball, parties, boyfriends, summers on the Chesapeake, and all of the other beginnings of life. But there was, in the midst of all of this, a gradual awakening to the reality of what it meant to be an intense, somewhat mercurial girl in a traditional and military world. Independence, temperament, and girlhood met very uneasily in the strange land of Cotillion. Navy Cotillion was where officers' children were supposed to learn the fine points of manners, dancing, white gloves, and other unrealities of life. It also was where children were supposed to learn, as if the preceding 14 or 15 years hadn't already made it painfully clear, that generals outrank colonels, who outrank majors and captains and lieutenants, and everyone but everyone outranks children. Within the ranks of children, boys always outranked girls. One way of grinding this particularly irritating pecking order into the young girls was to teach them the old and ridiculous art of curtsying. It was beyond belief to me that I would seriously be expected to do this. I saw the line of crisply crinoline girls in front of me and watched each of them curtsying neatly. Sheep, I thought. Sheep. Then it was my turn. Something inside of me came to a complete boil. It was one too many times watching one too many girls willingly go along with the rites of submission. I refused. Miss Courtney, our dancing teacher, glared. I refused again. She was, she said, very sure that Colonel Jameson would be terribly upset by this. I was, I said, very sure that Colonel Jameson couldn't care less. I was wrong. As it turns out, Colonel Jameson did care. However ridiculous he thought it was to be teaching girls to curtsy to officers and their wives, he cared very much more that I had been rude to someone. I apologized, and then he and I worked on a compromise curtsy, one that involved the slightest possible bending of knees and lowering of the body. It was one of my father's typically ingenious solutions to an intrinsically awkward situation. I resented the bowings, but I loved the elegance of the dress uniforms, the music, dancing, and the beauty of the cotillion evenings. However much I needed my independence, I would always be drawn to the world of tradition as well. There was a wonderful sense of security living within this walled-off military world. Had you told me, in those seemingly uncomplicated days of white gloves and broad-rimmed hats, that within 2 years I would be psychotic and want only to die, I would have laughed, wondered, and moved on. But mostly I would have laughed. And then, in the midst of my getting used to these changes and paradoxes, my father retired from the Air Force and took a job as a scientist at the RAND Corporation in California. It was 1961, I was 15 years old, and everything in my world began to fall apart. My first day at Pacific Palisades High School, which par for the course for a military child was months after the beginning of everyone else's school year, provided me with my opening clues that life was going to be very different. It started with the usual changing of the school's ritual chant, standing up in front of a classroom full of complete strangers and summing up one's life in an agonizing 3 minutes. As soon as I announced that my father had been an Air Force officer, I realized I could just as easily have said he was a black-footed ferret or a Carolinian newt. The only parental species recognized in Pacific Palisades were those in the industry, that is, the film business, or other wealthy Southern Californians. My understanding of the phrase civilian school was sharpened by the peals of laughter that followed my yes ma'ams and no sirs to the teachers. For a long time, I felt totally adrift. I missed Washington terribly. I had left behind a boyfriend without whom I was desperately unhappy. I also had left behind a life that had been filled with good friends, family closeness, great quantities of warmth and laughter, traditions I knew and loved, and a city that was home. More important, I had left behind a conservative military lifestyle that I had known as long as I could remember. It was a small, warm, unthreatening, and cloistered world. California, or at least Pacific Palisades, seemed to me to be cold and flashy. I lost my moorings almost entirely. And despite an ostensibly rapid adjustment to a new school and acquiring new friends, I was deeply unhappy. I was furious with my father for having taken a job in California instead of staying in Washington. I was behind in every subject, and it took forever to catch up. In fact, I don't think I ever did. But however bizarre this new world seemed to me, and I to it, I actually grew to cotton to its ways. Once I got over the initial shocks, I found most of my remaining experiences in high school a remarkable sort of education. But the past was indeed the past. The comfortable world of the military in Washington was gone. Everything had changed. My brother had gone off to college before we moved to California, leaving a large hole in my security net. My relationship with my sister, always a difficult one, had become at best fractious, often adversarial, and more usually simply distant. My parents, although still living together, were essentially estranged. My mother was busy teaching, looking after all of us, and going to graduate school. My father was caught up in his scientific work. His moods still, on occasion, soared, and when they did, the sparkle and gaiety that flew out from them created a glow, a warmth and joy that filled the house. But he sailed over the cusp of reason at times, and his grandiose ideas began to push the limits of what Rand could tolerate. With his capacity for flight came grimmer moods, and the blackness of his depressions filled the air as pervasively as music did in his better periods. Within a year or so of moving to California, my father's moods were further blackening, and I felt helpless to affect them. The high moods and awesome enthusiasms had given way to anger, despair, and bleak emotional withdrawal. After a while, I scarcely recognized him. At times, he was immobilized by depression, unable to get out of bed, and profoundly pessimistic. At other times, his rage and screaming would fill me with terror. I had never known my father, a soft-spoken and gentle man, to raise his voice. He also started drinking heavily, which made everything worse. My mother was as bewildered and frightened as I was, and both of us increasingly sought escape through work and friends. I soon found out, however, that it was not just my father who'd been given black and chaotic moods. By the time I was about 16 or 17, it became clear that my energies and enthusiasms could be exhausting to the people around me, and that after long weeks of flying high and sleeping little, my thinking would take a downward turn toward the really dark and brooding side of life. I was a senior in high school when I had my first attack of manic depressive illness. Once the process began, I lost my mind rather rapidly. At first, everything seemed so easy. I raced about like a crazed weasel, bubbling with plans and enthusiasms and staying up all night, night after night, out with friends, reading everything that wasn't nailed down, and making expansive, completely unrealistic plans for my future. The world was filled with pleasure and promise. I felt great. Not just great, I felt really great. I felt I could do anything, that no task was too difficult. My mind seemed clear, fabulously focused, and not only did everything make perfect sense, but it all began to fit into a marvelous kind of cosmic relatedness. My friends were less transfixed by my new and cosmic insights than I was, and more impressed by how exhausting it was to be around my enthusiastic ramblings. "You're talking too fast, Kay. Slow down, Kay. You're wearing me out, Kay. Slow down, Kay." I did finally slow down. In fact, I came to a grinding halt. Unlike the very severe manic episodes that came a few years later and escalated wildly and psychotically out of control, this first sustained wave of mild mania was a light, lovely tincture of true mania. It was short-lived and quickly burned itself out. Then the bottom began to fall out of my life and mind. My thinking was torturous. I would read the same passage over and over again, only to realize that I had no memory at all for what I just had read. Nothing made sense. I could not begin to follow the material presented in my classes, and I would find myself staring out of the window with no idea of what was going on around me. It was very frightening. I was used to my mind being my best friend, of carrying on endless conversations within my head, of having a built-in source of laughter or analytic thought to rescue me from boring or painful surroundings. I counted upon my mind's acuity, interest, and loyalty as a matter of course. Now, all of a sudden, my mind had turned on me. It mocked me for my vapid enthusiasms. It laughed at all of my foolish plans. It no longer found anything interesting or enjoyable or worthwhile. It was incapable of concentrated thought and turned time and time again to the subject of death. I was going to die. What difference did anything make? Life's run was only a short and meaningless one. Why live? Each day I awoke deeply tired, a feeling as foreign to my natural self as being bored or indifferent to life. Those were next. Then a gray, bleak preoccupation with death, dying, decaying, that everything was born but to die, best to die now and save the pain while waiting. I thought obsessively about killing myself. It was a tribute to my ability to present an image so at variance with what I felt that few noticed that I was in any way different. Certainly no one in my family did. Two friends were concerned, but I swore them to secrecy. One teacher noticed, and the parent of a friend called me aside to ask if something was wrong. I lied readily. I'm fine, but thank you for asking. I have no idea how I functioned in school, except that other people are generally caught up in their own lives and seldom notice despair in others. I made an enormous effort not to be noticed. I knew something was dreadfully wrong, but I had no idea what, and I had been brought up to believe that you kept your problems to yourself. Given that, it turned out to be unnervingly easy to keep my family and friends at psychological bay. Looking back, I am amazed I survived, that I survived on my own, and that high school contained such complicated life and palpable death. I aged rapidly during those months, as one must with such loss of oneself, with such proximity to death, and such distance from shelter. I was 18 when I reluctantly started my undergraduate studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. It was not where I wanted to go. I wanted to go to the University of Chicago because it had a reputation for tolerating nonconformity, and because both my father and my mother's father, a physicist, had gone there for graduate school. This was financially impossible. My father's erratic behavior had cost him his job at RAND, so unlike most of my friends who went off to Harvard, Stanford, or Yale, I applied to the University of California. UCLA, however, turned out to be the best possible place for me. The University of California provided me an excellent and idiosyncratic education, an opportunity to do independent research, and the wide berth that perhaps only a large university can afford a tempestuous temperament. It could not, however, provide any meaningful protection against the terrible agitation and pain within my mind. College, for many people I know, was the best time of their lives. This is inconceivable to me. College was, for the most part, a terrible struggle, a recurring nightmare of violent and dreadful moods, spelled only now and again by weeks, sometimes months, of great fun, passion, high enthusiasm, and long runs of very hard but enjoyable work. This pattern of shifting feelings and energies had a very seductive side, in large part because of the fitful reinfusions of the intoxicating moods that I had enjoyed in high school. They were quite extraordinary, filling my brain with a cataract of ideas and more than enough energy to give me the illusion of carrying them out. Almost everything was done to excess. Instead of buying one Beethoven symphony, I would buy nine. Instead of enrolling for five classes, I would enroll in seven. Instead of buying two tickets for a concert, I would buy 8 or 10. I was working 20 to 30 hours a week in order to pay my way through college, and there was no margin at all for the expenses I ran up during these times of high enthusiasms. Unfortunately, the pink overdraft notices from my bank always seemed to arrive when I was in the throes of depression. Much as it had during my senior year in high school, my classwork during these galvanized periods seemed very straightforward, and I found examinations, laboratory work, and papers almost absurdly easy during the weeks that the high-flying times would last. I also would become immersed in a variety of political and social causes, everything from campus anti-war activities to slightly more idiosyncratic zealotries, such as protesting cosmetic firms that killed turtles to manufacture and sell beauty products. But then, inevitably, my mood would crash and my mind again would grind to a halt. I lost all interest in my schoolwork, friends, reading, wandering, or mulling. I would wake up in the morning with a profound sense of dread that I was going to have to somehow make it through another entire day. I would sit for hour after hour in the undergraduate library, unable to muster up enough energy to go to class. When I did go to class, it was pointless. Pointless and painful. I understood very little of what was going on, and I felt as though only dying would release me from the overwhelming sense of inadequacy and blackness that surrounded me. On occasion, these periods of total despair would be made even worse by terrible agitation. My mind would start racing quickly from subject to subject, but instead of being filled with exuberant and cosmic thoughts, it would be drenched in awful sounds and images of decay and dying. During these agitated periods, I became exceedingly restless, angry, and irritable. And the only way I could dilute the agitation was to run along the beach or pace back and forth across my room. I felt totally unable to ask anyone for help. It never occurred to me that I was ill. My brain just didn't put it in those terms. Finally, however, after hearing a lecture about depression in my abnormal psychology course, I went to the Student Health Service with the intention of asking to see a psychiatrist. I got as far as the stairwell just outside the clinic, but was only able to sit there, paralyzed with fear and shame, unable to go in and unable to leave. I must have sat there sobbing for over an hour. Then I left and never went back. Eventually, the depression went away of its own accord, but only long enough to regroup and mobilize for the next attack. For each awfulness in life, however, I seem to have been given an offsetting stroke of luck. One of these occurred in my freshman year. I was taking an upper division psychology course in personality theory, and the professor was demonstrating different ways to assess personality and cognitive structure. He held up Rorschach cards and asked us to write down our responses. Years of staring up into the clouds and tracing their patterns finally paid off. My mind was flying high that day, and I filled page after page with what I am sure were very strange responses. Everyone's responses were passed forward and handed to the professor. He read aloud from a random selection. Midway through, I heard a recital of somewhat odd associations, and I realized to my horror that they were mine. Most of the class was laughing, and I stared at my feet in mortification. When the professor had finished, he asked if the person who had written these particular responses would please stay behind to talk with him. I was convinced that, being a psychologist, he could see straight into my psychotic underpinnings. I was terrified. Looking back on it, what I suspect he actually saw was someone who was very intense, quite determined, serious, and probably rather troubled. He said that he had never encountered such, quote, imaginative, unquote, responses to the Rorschach. He was kind enough to call creative that which some no doubt would have called psychotic. It was my first lesson in appreciating the complicated, permeable boundaries between bizarre and original thought, and I remain deeply indebted to him for the intellectual tolerance that cast a positive rather than a pathological hue over what I had written. The professor asked me about my background, and I explained that I was a freshman, wanted to become a doctor, and that I was working my way through school. He pointed out that his course was for juniors and seniors only. I said I knew that, but it looked interesting, and besides that, the rule seemed completely arbitrary. He laughed out loud, and I suddenly realized that I was finally in a situation where someone actually respected my independence. He said he had a position for a lab assistant and asked me if I would be interested. I was more than interested. It meant that I could give up my unremittingly boring job and that I could learn to do research. It was a wonderful experience. I learned to code and analyze data, program computers, review the research literature, design studies, and write up scientific papers for publication. I immersed myself in the work and found that it was not only a source of education and income, but escape as well. Unlike attendance in classes, the research life allowed an independence and flexibility of schedule that were exhilarating. My undergraduate transcript was riddled with failing grades and incomplete classes, but my research papers, fortunately, offset my often dreary grades. My mercurial moods and recurrent depressions took a huge personal and academic toll during those college years. Then, at the age of 20, after 2 years of undergraduate studies, I took off a year from the turmoil that had become my life to study at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. St. Andrews, said my tutor, was the only place he knew where it snowed horizontally. An eminent neurophysiologist, he was a tall, lanky, and droll Yorkshireman who, like many of his fellow English, believed that rather superior weather, to say nothing of civilization, ended where the Scottish countryside began. He had a point about the weather. The ancient, gray stone town of St. Andrews sits right on the North Sea, and takes blasts of late autumn and winter winds that have to be experienced to be believed. I had been living in Scotland for several months by that time, and I had become a definite believer. That year I walked for long, long hours along the sea and through the town, and sat for hours mulling and writing among the ancient ruins of the city. I never tired of imagining what the 12th century cathedral must once have been, what glorious stained glass must once have filled its now empty stone-edged windows. Nor could I escape the almost archetypal pullings of Sunday services in the college chapel, which, like the university itself, had been built during the early 15th century. The medieval traditions of learning and religion were threaded together in a deeply mystifying and wonderful way. The thick scarlet gowns of the undergraduates, brightly colored because of an early Scottish king's decree that students, as potentially dangerous to the state, should be easily recognized, brought vivid contrast to the gray buildings of the town, and, after chapel, the red-gowned students would walk to the end of the town's pier, further extending their vivid contrast to the dark skies and the sea. It was, it is, a mystical place, full of memories of cold, clear nights, and men and women in evening dress, long gloves, silk scarves and kilts, long banks of daffodils and bluebells on the hills above the sea, seaweed and rocks and limpet shells along the yellow high-tided sands, and ravishingly beautiful Christmas services at the end of term. Leaving the chapel late on a winter night was to enter onto an ancient scene, the sight of scarlet against snow, the ringing of bells, and a clear full moon. St. Andrew's provided a gentle forgetfulness over the preceding painful years of my life. It remains a haunting and lovely time to me. For one who, during her undergraduate years, was seeking to escape an inexplicable weariness and despair, St. Andrew's was an amulet against all manner of longing and loss, a year of gravely held but joyous remembrances. Throughout and beyond the long North Sea winter, it was the Indian summer of my life. I was 21 years old when I left Scotland and returned to UCLA. It was an abrupt shift in mood and surroundings, and an even more abrupt disruption to the pace of my life. I tried to settle back into my old world and routines, but found it difficult to do so. I once again had to juggle my work, classes, social life, and disruptive moods. My career plans also had changed. It had become clear to me over time that my mercurial temperament and physical restlessness were going to make medical school an unlikely proposition. I loved research and writing, and the thought of being chained to the kind of schedule that medical school required was increasingly repugnant. Just as important, I had read William James's great psychological study, The Varieties of Religious Experience, during my year in St. Andrews, and had become completely captivated by the idea of studying psychology, especially individual differences in temperament and variations in emotional capacities. I also had begun working with another professor on his research grant, a fascinating study of the psychological and physiological effects of mood-altering drugs. He, like me, was intrigued by moods. My tremendous enjoyment and education from the work I was doing with him, the continued satisfaction in my other work with a more mathematically inclined professor with whom I had been working since my freshman year, the strong influence of William James, and the instability and restlessness of my own temperament all combined to help me make up my mind to study for a PhD in psychology rather than to go to medical school. UCLA was then and still is one of the best graduate programs in psychology in the United States. I applied for admission and began my doctoral studies in 1971. Graduate school was the fun I missed as an undergraduate. It was a continuation, in some respects, of the Indian summer I enjoyed in St. Andrews. Looking back, I realized I was experiencing what is so coldly and prosaically known as a remission, common in the early years of manic depressive illness, and a deceptive respite from the savagely recurrent course that the untreated illness ultimately takes. But I assumed I was just back to my normal self. Graduate school was not only relative freedom for me from my illness, but it was also freedom from the highly structured existence of undergraduate studies. Although I skipped more than half of my formal lectures, it didn't really matter. As long as one ultimately performed, the erratic ways that one took to get there were considerably less important. I was married, too, by this point, to a French artist who not only was a talented painter, but an exceedingly kind and gentle person. The safety of our marriage, the closeness of good friends, and the intellectual latitude provided by graduate school were very powerful in providing a reasonably quiet and harbored world. I had started off studying experimental psychology, but I decided to switch to clinical psychology. I had an increasingly personal as well as professional interest in the field. My coursework now switched to psychopharmacology, psychopathology, clinical methods, and psychotherapy. Psychopathology, the scientific study of mental disorders, proved enormously interesting, and I found that seeing patients was not only fascinating, but intellectually and personally demanding as well. I still did not make any connection in my own mind between the problems I had experienced and what was described as manic depressive illness in the textbooks. Looking back on it, my denial and ignorance seem virtually incomprehensible. I noticed, though, that I was far more comfortable treating psychotic patients than were many of my colleagues. At that time, psychoanalytic theory still predominated. So, for the first 2 years of treating patients, I was supervised almost entirely by psychoanalysts. The emphasis in treatment was on understanding early experiences and conflicts. Dreams and symbols and their interpretation form the core of psychotherapeutic work. A more medical approach to psychopathology, one that centered on diagnosis, symptoms, illness, and medical treatments, came only after I started my internship at the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute. Most of my real education came from the wide variety and large number of patients that I evaluated and treated during my pre-doctoral clinical internships. Along the way, I completed the coursework for my two minor fields, psychopharmacology and animal behavior as well. Qualifying examinations came and went. I conducted my doctoral study, wrote my dissertation, and then, after 2 weeks of frantically cramming trivia into my brain, I walked into a room filled with five unsmiling men seated around a table, sat down, and went through the ordeal that is politely known as a final oral examination, or, more aptly, in a military sense, the defense of one's dissertation. After 3 hours of an intricate intellectual ballet, I left the room and stood in the hallway while they voted, endured the requisite moments of agony, and returned to find the same five men who, hours earlier, had seemed so grim and unfriendly. But this time they were smiling. Their hands were outstretched to shake mine, and they all said, to my vast relief and pleasure, "Congratulations, Dr. Jameson." I was hired as an assistant professor in the UCLA Department of Psychiatry, got good parking for the first time in my life, joined the faculty club post-haste, and began to work my way up the academic food chain. I had a glorious summer, and within 3 months of becoming a professor, I was ravingly psychotic. There is a particular kind of pain, elation, loneliness, and terror involved in this kind of madness. When you're high, it's tremendous. The ideas and feelings are fast and frequent like shooting stars, and you follow them until you find better and brighter ones. Shyness goes. The right words and gestures are suddenly there. The power to captivate others, a felt certainty. There are interests found in uninteresting people. Sensuality is pervasive, and the desire to seduce and be seduced irresistible. Feelings of ease, intensity, power, well-being, financial omnipotence, and euphoria pervade one's marrow. But somewhere this changes. The fast ideas are far too fast, and there are far too many. Overwhelming confusion replaces clarity. Memory goes. Humor and absorption on friends' faces are replaced by fear and concern. Everything previously moving with the grain is now against. You are irritable, angry, frightened, uncontrollable, and enmeshed totally in the blackest caves of the mind. You never knew those caves were there. It will never end, for madness carves its own reality. It goes on, and finally there are only others' recollections of your behavior, your bizarre, frenetic, aimless behaviors, for mania has at least some grace in partially obliterating memories. What then, after the medications, psychiatrist, despair, depression, and overdose? All those incredible feelings to sort through. Who is being too polite to say what? Who knows what? What did I do? Why? And most hauntingly, when will it happen again? Then, too, are the bitter reminders. Medicine to take, resent, forget, take, resent, and forget, but always to take. Credit cards revoked, bounced checks to cover, explanations due at work, apologies to make, intermittent memories, what did I do? Friendships gone or drained, a ruined marriage. And always, when will it happen again? Which of my feelings are real? Which of the me's is me? The wild, impulsive, chaotic, energetic, and crazy one? Or the shy, withdrawn, desperate, suicidal, doomed, and tired one? Probably a bit of both. Hopefully, much that is neither. Virginia Woolf and her dives and climbs said it all. How far do our feelings take their color from the dive underground? I mean, what is the reality of any feeling? I did not wake up one day to find myself mad. Life should be so simple. Rather, I gradually became aware that my life and mind were going at an ever faster and faster clip until finally, over the course of my first summer on the faculty, they both had spun wildly and completely out of control. But the acceleration from quick thought to chaos was a slow and beautifully seductive one. In the beginning, everything seemed perfectly normal. I joined the psychiatry faculty in July of 1974 and was assigned to one of the adult inpatient wards for my clinical and teaching responsibilities. I was expected to supervise psychiatric residents and clinical psychology interns. I was also the faculty liaison between the departments of psychiatry and anesthesiology, where I did consultations, seminars, and put into place some research protocols. My own research consisted primarily of writing up some of the drug studies I had carried out in graduate school. I had no particular interest in either clinical work or research related to mood disorders, and indeed, as I had been almost entirely free of serious mood swings for more than a year, I assumed that these problems were behind me. I settled into my new job with great optimism and energy. I enjoyed teaching, and although it initially seemed strange to be supervising the clinical work of others, I liked it. The relative freedom I had to pursue my own academic interests was intoxicating. I worked very hard and slept very little. Decreased sleep is both a symptom of mania and a cause, but I didn't know that at the time. Summer had often brought me longer nights and higher moods, but this time it pushed me into far higher, more dangerous and psychotic moods than I had ever known. Summer, a lack of sleep, a deluge of work, and exquisitely vulnerable genes eventually took me to the back of beyond, past my familiar exuberance, and into florid madness. The Chancellor's Garden Party was given annually to welcome new faculty members to UCLA. By coincidence, the man who was to become my psychiatrist also happened to be attending the garden party, having himself just joined the adjunct medical school faculty. It proved to be an interesting example of the divide between one's self-perception and the cooler, more measured observations of an experienced clinician. My memories of the garden party were that I had had a fabulous, bubbly, seductive, assured time. My psychiatrist, however, in talking with me about it much later, recalled it very differently. I seemed to him to be frenetic and far too talkative. He says he remembers having thought to himself, "Kay looks manic." I, on the other hand, had thought I was splendid. My mind was, however, beginning to have to scramble a bit to keep up with itself, as ideas were coming so fast that they intersected one another at every conceivable angle. The more I tried to slow down my thinking, the more I became aware that I couldn't. My enthusiasms were going into overdrive as well, although there often was some underlying thread of logic in what I was doing. One day, for example, I got into a frenzy of photocopying. I photocopied 30 to 40 copies of a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay, an article about religion and psychosis from the American Journal of Psychiatry, and another article called "Why I Do Not Attend Case Conferences," written by a prominent psychologist who had elucidated why teaching rounds, when poorly conducted, are such a horrendous waste of time. All three of these articles had seemed to me quite suddenly to have profound meaning and relevance for the clinical staff on the ward, so I passed them out to everyone I could. During the same period of increasingly feverish behavior at work, my marriage was falling apart. I separated from my husband, ostensibly because I wanted children and he did not, which was true and important, but it was far more complicated than that. I was increasingly restless, irritable, and I craved excitement. All of a sudden, I found myself rebelling against the very things I most loved about my husband, his kindness, stability, warmth, and love. I impulsively reached out for a new life. I found an exceedingly modern apartment in Santa Monica, although I hated modern architecture. I bought modern finished furniture, although I loved warm and old-fashioned things. Everything I acquired was cool, modern, angular, and I suppose strangely soothing and relatively uninvasive of my increasingly chaotic mind and jangled nerves. There was, at least, a spectacular, and spectacularly expensive, view of the ocean. Spending a lot of money that you don't have is a classic part of mania. Having a PhD in economics from Harvard in no way prepared my brother for the sprawling financial mess he saw on the floor in front of him. There were piles of credit card receipts, stacks of pink overdraft notices from my bank, and duplicate and triplicate billings from all of the stores through which I had so recently swirled and charged. In a separate, more ominous pile were threatening letters from collection agencies. The chaotic visual impact upon entering the room reflected the higgledy-piggledy pixelated collection of electric lobes that only a few weeks earlier had constituted my manic brain. Now, medicated and dreary, I was obsessively sifting through the remnants of my fiscal irresponsibility. It was like going on an archaeological dig through earlier ages of one's mind. Near the top of the pile was a bill from the pharmacy where I had gotten snake bite kits. The pharmacist, having just filled my first prescription for lithium, had smiled knowingly as he rang up the sale for my snake bite kits and other absurd and bizarre purchases. I knew what he was thinking, but he, unlike me, was unaware of the life-threatening problem caused by rattlesnakes in the San Fernando Valley. God had chosen me to alert the world to the proliferation of killer snakes in the Promised Land. Or so I thought in my scattered delusional meanderings. I kept on with my life at a frightening pace. I worked ridiculously long hours and slept next to not at all. When I went home at night, it was to a place of increasing chaos. Books, many newly purchased, were strewn everywhere. Clothes were piled up in every room, and there were unwrapped packages and unemptied shopping bags as far as the eye could see. My awareness and experience of sounds in general, and music in particular, was intense. Individual notes from a horn, an oboe, or a cello became exquisitely poignant. Soon, the intensity and sadness of music became unbearable to me. The chaos in my mind began to mirror the chaos of my rooms. I could no longer process what I was hearing. I became confused, scared, and disoriented. Slowly the darkness began to weave its way into my mind, and before long I was hopelessly out of control. I could not follow the path of my own thoughts. One evening I stood in the middle of my living room and looked out at a blood-red sunset. Suddenly I felt a strange sense of light at the back of my eyes and almost immediately saw a huge black centrifuge inside my head. I saw a tall figure in a floor-length evening gown approach the centrifuge with a vase-sized tube of blood in her hand. As the figure turned around, I saw to my horror that it was me, and that there was blood all over my dress. I watched as the figure carefully put the tube of blood into the rack of the centrifuge, closed the lid, and pushed a button. The centrifuge began to whirl. Then, horrifyingly, the image that previously had been inside my head now was completely outside of it. I was paralyzed by fright. The spinning of the centrifuge and the clanking of the glass tube against the metal became louder and louder, and then the machine splintered into 1,000 pieces. Blood was everywhere. I screamed at the top of my lungs. I couldn't get away from the sight of the blood and the echoes of the machine's clanking as it whirled faster and faster. Not only had my thoughts spun wild, they had turned into an awful phantasmagoria, an apt but terrifying vision of an entire life and mind out of control. I screamed again and again. Slowly, the hallucinations receded. I telephoned a colleague for help, poured myself a large scotch, and waited for his arrival. Fortunately, before my mania could become very public, this colleague was willing to take on my manic wrath and delusions. He confronted me with the need to take lithium, which was not a pleasant task for him. I was wildly agitated, paranoid, and physically violent. But it was one he carried out with great skill, grace, and understanding. He was very gentle but insistent when he told me that he thought I had manic depressive illness.